I feel that we have a relatively narrow subject, and most of the things that can possibly be said about it have already been said. So I don't know whether I will be able to add much to it, but I think this is an exercise about food for thought, and I might try to add a little bit to it. I've got a PowerPoint presentation here, which was concocted by some of my collaborators, so I will try to keep up with it. But you can see that they invented a very, very cumbersome title. Yes, it's true, Austria is a country both of transit and of destination of human trafficking, and we are trying to put up with challenges as best we can. This is a little overview of what I'm going to talk about. I'll give you a picture of where Austria stands, how we are trying to approach the problem. We are a relatively small country, not as big as Greece, for example, 8.7 million, split up in nine provinces. And we have a legal framework, which is not the Swedish model and not really the Dutch model, but if we had to make a choice, it would be closer to the Dutch model. But as people have been saying before, there's no really such a thing as a clear model. Every country tries to find something that would suit its situation and also suit what the governments believe and how best to cope with the problem. So what we have is a situation of regulation in Austria. Prostitution is not forbidden. It is regulated. So insofar, it is a counter model to the Swedish model. It doesn't mean that we think prostitution is a good thing. And I'm saying so as a woman, I don't like the idea of people selling, women selling themselves. What we think is that people should not be a commodity, but the best way of trying to achieve that is to choose the lesser evil, which is to say, if we can't be sure that we can get rid of prostitution, then we better regulate it. Because the advantage of regulating is that you can then check whether the regulations have actually been respected. And this is what our government are doing, what our parliament has decided, and this is what I'm going to talk a little bit as a food for thought in this debate. So we have federal law, which is criminal law, which sets the general regulations and also collateral things like immigration law, tax law, social security law, health law and criminal law. And then we have nine different sets of regional legislations. They're slightly different in that the situation is different. You can probably guess that Vienna, which is the only really big city in Austria, has a more liberal regulation on prostitution than most of the other areas. So these nine prostitution laws, they have a few features in common. One is that there is an age limit, depending on the province, 18 or 19 years. So we do not allow prostitution with minors of age. Illegal prostitutes have to be mentally healthy. They have to register, which I understand is a bit different from the Dutch model, depending on where they live, either with the police or with the municipality. They can work in either licensed brothels. In some provinces, they can also work at home. The only place where they can work in the street and only in two limited areas in the margins of the city is Vienna. And there can be regulations on what times prostitution is allowed. So as I said before, Vienna is more liberal than most of the provinces. The more you go west, the less liberal it becomes. Now, to take Vienna as an example of a big city, prostitution is when there is body contact. In Vienna, it can take place in brothels, it can take place at the client's place, it can take place in the streets. Brothels have to be licensed. There has to be a responsible person who is checked on his reliability. There have to be safety features in the brothel. There has to be emergency buttons and other features. There is a control of hygienic standards. There have to be certain safety features for the women, in particular lockers. There have to be health checks. Women have to go regularly, once a week, once a month. It used to be once a week, now it's once a month for a health check. And all these possibilities for authorities to control what is going on is the reason why the government, at least at this stage, doesn't want to give up the model we have, because they say it's better we can check and we can find out about the worst circumstances than believing that if we forbid something, it will not take place. Our federal criminal law is mostly signed up with what the international and European law provisions foresee. So you have trafficking for human beings is a criminal offense in its own, defined much along the lines as European law, which is that recruitment, harboring, reception, transportation, transfer of control, and offering an adult person, all of these are human trafficking. Unfair means, like in most other countries, are the use of force, severe threat, deception, abuse of power. There has to be an element of exploitation, as we all know. Exploitation includes sexual exploitation, exploitation by labor, so labor exploitation, removal of organs, forced begging, and other punishable acts. And there are aggravating circumstances. So if there is a criminal association, the fine can be twice as much. Severe violence, deliberately trafficking, all these are aggravating circumstances, and there can never be trafficking in children. So if a child is exploited, even if there were consent by the child, that would never be accepted as consent, and there would be an aggravated fine for people trafficking children up to the year of 18. In case somebody doesn't do the trafficking himself, but either forces somebody else to do the trafficking or somehow contributes, the fine would be the same as for the perpetrator. This is general criminal law in Austria, that if you are a contributor, you can be fined in the same way as the perpetrator himself. Now, this is rather strict, but the legislator said there is somehow a gap. If we have this strict kind of legislation, there might be some cases which escape us, and therefore we have a relatively recent new provision, which is about criminalizing the violation to the right to sexual self-determination. Now, this is about cases which are a bit less bad than human trafficking, because there's no violence involved, because there is no particularly vulnerable person involved, but still there is sex against the will of that person, and maybe in the case that the consumer, the client, knows that the prostitute is actually a victim of human trafficking. So in this case, we have the punishment of knowing about the problem, even though we all know that it is always very difficult in a criminal procedure to prove what somebody knew. There is also a new provision on criminalizing forced marriages. Forced marriages are a phenomenon which we increasingly find in the context of human trafficking. There has been a rather celebrated study on this between Latvia and Ireland, cases where the free circulation within the European Union was exploited. Women who usually were mentally a bit handicapped were invited to go to Ireland, thus exercising their free circulation within the EU. And then they were more or less forced to marry African men, then disappear again. They were given money for it in the best of cases. Not all of them were given money. And then these African men who had landed themselves in Ireland could go on making family come to Ireland. So we do have these schemes of forced marriage. We also have some cases in Austria, which I'm not going to elaborate on in detail because my time is running out. But let's not forget about forced marriages in the context of human trafficking. Now we have another criminal provision as well, which is about the transnational trade of prostitution. So prostitution in Austria is allowed under certain circumstances, but if it becomes transnational, it is conceived to be a crime and is sanctioned as such. There can be aggravating circumstances as well. Pimping is criminalized under that same provision, and as I said before, there can be no prostitution with minors of age. On the realities that we have, 50% of the prostitution going on in Austria is supposed to be in Vienna. We have about 8,000 registered sex workers, 2% of whom only are male. 95% of the sex workers are migrants, so they come from Eastern Europe, countries like Romania, Hungary, Bulgaria. Recently, we have had a major case, which still isn't finished, a human trafficking case with women coming from China. 150 supposed victims have been identified, none of whom have spoken so far. So they're now trying to do special investigations in order to find out more about what's going on. So there is a lot of that. We have 800 brothels in the country, but there is a certain tendency moving away from the old type of brothels to something which is going on in apartment houses, which sometimes can be compared more to supermarkets of prostitution. Not very nice, the idea. So the men come in, there is no preliminary with champagne or anything. They choose the girl they like, and then they go ahead. It's all not very nice, as I said. But what our people are thinking is, how can we best contain what is going on? Now, on the non-registered, the non-legal prostitution, there is an estimate that there are about 3,000 to 4,000 women. Interestingly, there's a higher amount of Austrian women among those, probably because they want to do it anonymously, also probably because they want to avoid health checks, also probably because they don't want to pay tax. Different names are found for these things, like go-go bars and escort services and so on. That's not so very different from what's going on in other countries. The data of trafficking which we have, the most recent I have here, go back to 2015. You see them on the slide. 98 cases of investigations, most of those trans-border joint investigations. You see here the number of suspects and of victims. 73% of cases on human trafficking concern sexual exploitation, but it also shows that sexual exploitation is not, by the way, not the only phenomenon of human trafficking which we get in Austria. There is quite a lot of labor exploitation, most of which in households, also in the context of care for the elderly, because that's a typical situation where the public doesn't see very much of what is going on. Now, like other countries, we have a task force on combating human trafficking. I have the honor of being the chair of that. All the ministries of the country are involved, as well as representatives of the federal provinces, of relevant NGOs who are very important in that task force because they do the reality check. And then we have social partners on board. We strive to propose to the government a national action plan on fighting human trafficking every 3 years, and we cooperate so that we can check whether we're actually implementing it. There is a support system financed by the governments for victims of human trafficking. So you have the first organization is dealing with the female victims of human trafficking. They have quite a lot of experience. They have been doing that for over 10 years now. More recent is the support center for male victims of human trafficking. There was for a long time a belief that one didn't really need it, but as soon as we had this support for male victims, we find out they were overburdened. Very quickly it turned out there were more cases than met the eye. And finally, what I would like to mention is that the government has recently created an institution which is called UNDOC, and that is actually a place, a low-level place, where people can turn if their labor rights are not being respected. So the idea is to say, even if you don't have a right of legal residence in the country, you are still entitled to benefit from our labor laws. And if you are exploited, you can come and we will help you. And this is an extremely successful little agency because they have already discovered quite a lot of people who, for example, workers who after extreme work in Austria fell ill, discovered that they didn't have a health insurance, and this center would help them. Now, on the question which we have been discussing quite a lot already, why should one regulate? Or why does the Austrian government as well as the Austrian parliament think one should regulate? You have some of the reasons here. Because if you don't regulate, we believe that it hits the wrong persons. If you have regulation, the sex worker can make a choice, can say, I will work under these circumstances, but not under those circumstances. We also think that prohibiting prostitution does not do away with the moral double standards, which we've heard about this morning. It doesn't do anything good, really, for the sex workers. We don't think either that the market laws of supply and demand are actually enough to explain what is going on in this area, certainly not in the area of human trafficking. Many people believe that if you prohibit sex work, it goes underground. I'll say more about that later on. That the women then become increasingly dependent on middlemen, that it doesn't help if the state cannot check what is going on, and that it doesn't help if there are no longer NGOs who are specifically mandated to help in these cases. Now, I don't want to be mean on Sweden, really not because we also don't have the ideal model, but it doesn't mean that if you prohibit prostitution, it doesn't take place. A very fast look at the internet shows there are lots of possibilities in Sweden. And I must admit, I made this photograph myself when I was in Sweden. I was not searching for it, but it was standing in front of the Stockholm Opera. It was a disappointment for me too, because I thought it would help if you prohibit prostitution, but it does not necessarily. So, going on. The uses of a victim, as we all know, the Council of Europe Convention prohibits that. It doesn't say that you should, that states should prohibit prostitution. It just says they should criminalize the use of the services of a victim. There was, by the way, last year, a study published by the UN Commission on the status of women, which also said not to prohibit prostitution, but to regulate it, to make sure that the conditions are improved, in particular with regard to health of the women and with regard to social services. And it also recommended to recognize prostitution as work. I know this is not an easy thing and not a nice thing, but maybe it's a lesser evil, as I said before. So this I have already said before. Only to join Professor Piotrowicz in saying that we don't really believe that there is sufficient evidence that prohibition really helps. And we think that some of the figures given might benefit from getting some more research. We don't think that, as I said before, the law of supply and demand is sufficient to explain what is going on in this particular area. It might just push everything into the illegal sphere. If you have threat and violence and things like that, it's not the same thing as supply and demand. And if you prohibit prostitution, what might happen is that the nicer clients might stop it. But unfortunately, not the less nice clients, the one who are sort of on the margin of being becoming human traffickers. And this, I think, is what some English British lawyers refer to as the cocoa fallacy. I don't know whether you are familiar with a comic operetta called The Mikado. The Mikado being, as you know, the Emperor of Japan. The whole thing plays in the 19th century, and it's one of these plays where the Victorians are making fun of themselves. In this case, they make fun of very strict legislation, which very often ends up in capital punishment in this sort of imaginative Japan that is being portrayed. Now, one of the things that people can get capital punishment for in that comical opera is if they flirt with the wrong person. Now, there is this figure of the Lord High Executioner who decides that the particular young man should be executed because he has fallen in love with the young lady whom the Lord Executioner wants to marry himself. So what they do is that this young man is executed, and because they can't arrange it otherwise, he is executed in writing. What the Lord Executioner doesn't know is that the young man is the son of the emperor in disguise. And then, to his great surprise, the emperor comes along, and he thinks the emperor wants to check whether there are enough executions. And then he says, yes, of course, this man has been executed. And he says, literally, when your majesty says, let the thing be done, then it is practically as good as done. And when your majesty says that somebody should die, then he is legally dead. And if he's legally dead, we might as well say he's dead. Now, this is what they call the Coco fallacy. If you prohibit something, then it'll be gone. In the present case, the Lord High Executioner is very relieved when he finds out that the emperor is not actually checking whether there have been enough executions, but he's trying to find his son, and that this young man is the son of the emperor. Then in the end of the day, he is happy that prohibition wasn't the same thing as abolition. But to this now explain what is the Coco fallacy, that if you prohibit something, it will be gone, that is not something that we believe in. And therefore, we have the kind of regulations that we have. But of course, we know they are a lesser evil. We also have provisions in other fields of human trafficking. For example, in order to fight labor exploitation, we are now introducing a law for public tenders, which will say for public tenders, the government should not take the cheapest bid, but it should take the best bid. So there can be qualitative criteria, and this will be one way of trying to combat this course towards the cheapest product, which of course is risky in the context of human trafficking. With regard to organ trafficking, we have in Austria a legal presumption, which is that any person who has not explicitly said that he or she doesn't want his organs to be used in the case of an accident has actually agreed. So organs can be used in Austria after an accident, and this is, I think, one of the reasons, or not only I think, we think one of the reasons why we don't have cases of organ trafficking in Austria, because it's relatively easy to organize. And we have, of course, very strict rules on minors of age. There will always be doubtful cases where the legislator and also the judge does not quite know what to do with them. When is a beggar a victim of human trafficking? When is somebody who washes your car windows a victim of human trafficking? When is a living statue a victim of human trafficking? All these cases have been seen, but it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody who is a window washer or a beggar is a victim of human trafficking. So there, it is very important to work on the particular case. Finally, I would like to add, we have also provisions on the compensation for victims of human trafficking. So in case the perpetrator doesn't pay, the government will make a certain payment, not huge, but something. And we also offer victims of human trafficking access to the labor market. So we hope that with this package of legal provisions, we can tackle the problem as best we can under our given circumstances. And I'll stop here. Thank you very much for your attention.